Wood Mackenzie's online future-facing commodities forum is back for its third year. Join us online on March the 27th for an open discussion with our experts on renewables, EVs, and advanced battery technology. There'll be two events on that date, one during the day in the Asia-Pacific region, and one during the day in Europe and the Americas. So you should be able to find a time to suit you, wherever you are in the world. At either one, you'll be able to get insights from our unparalleled integrated coverage of the renewables, battery, and electric vehicles value chains. You'll be able to hear our industry-leading analysts unpack their forecasts for key future-facing commodities, including lithium, nickel, copper, aluminium, and rare earths. Learn how technology, geopolitics, and regulation are transforming the metals markets as we build an electrified future. To register, go to go.woodmac.com/FFCF2024. You can find the details in today's show notes. Hello, and welcome to The Energy Gang, a conversation show about the fast-moving world of energy. I'm Ed Crooks. On this show, we're going to be talking about AI and its huge demand for electricity. How can we meet that demand while taking the carbon out of the energy system? And we're also going to be talking about the 1.5 degree target for limiting global warming. Is it time to give up on it and move to something more realistic? So to talk about those subjects, I'm joined by Amy Myers Jaffe, who's the Director of the Energy, Climate Justice and Sustainability Lab at New York University. Hi, Amy. How are you? Welcome back.
Thanks, Ed. Great to be here.
And it's also good to welcome back Samantha Gross, who's the Director of the Energy Security and Climate Initiative at the Brookings Institution. Hi, Samantha. Welcome back. How are you?
Good. Thank you for having me again.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. So as I was saying, I want to talk about AI, first of all. This seems to be the hot topic in the electricity industry right now. Surging electricity demand, especially to power the data centers for AI. Data centers used to have power demand measures in the tens of megawatts. Now they're in the hundreds of megawatts. And the new ones that are being proposed to deal with these more sophisticated AI applications have demand in the thousands of megawatts, gigawatts. And it does seem like that's going to have a really material impact on electricity demand around the world. Just thinking about specifically US power demand, basically flatlined for about 15 years from before the Great Financial Crisis, 2006-07, up to about 2022. Essentially, it went nowhere. But now it does look like it's starting to take off again. And we've got, as I say, these new data centers for AI. There's other things going on as well. There is a manufacturing investment revival going on in the US, partly because of the Inflation Reduction Act and the incentives for clean energy manufacturing in the US, partly because of this big effort to bring chip manufacturing, semiconductor manufacturing back to the US. New factories are being built. They've got very significant energy demand. You also, of course, have hydrogen. That hydrogen industry is starting to get going, electrolyzers to make green hydrogen out of water. That's a potential big new source of power demand. And we have all the things that people are doing in their homes, electric vehicles, heat pumps, shifting generally away from burning fuels towards using electricity as the energy source. That really is an essential part of decarbonization. It's not a bad thing that it's happening, but it is creating all these new demands on the grid, and that's creating a lot of problems for grid operators, for utilities, people who try to meet that demand. And when you look at how that demand for power is being met, the answer is very often it's gas. Well, at Distributec, which is the big conference for the power industry, where we were a couple of weeks ago, and you may have heard the shows that the Energy Gang recorded at Distributec, an executive from Duke Energy, which is a big US utility, was talking, and he said, how are we going to meet this demand? We're going to have a lot more renewables, we're going to have more gas, and eventually we're going to have more nuclear power. Okay, more renewable energy, that's great. More gas, though, is clearly a problem if we want to get the power system to net zero. So, question, what can be done and how can we shift that, what looks like pretty clear future that's been laid out for the US power system, i.e. more renewables and more gas, can that be shifted towards a path that does actually head towards net zero? Amy, what do you think?
Well, Ed, it's ironic that we're talking about this surge in demand and how we're going to meet it, because of course, natural gas prices were on the floor. I mean, we hit down to $1.50 per million BTU. We're back up to $1.79, but that's because the two big producers, Chesapeake and EQT, cut 1 BCFD, which is big. I mean, to take that amount out of the market, it still didn't lift the prices off the bottom. And then at the same time, we've had this flood of solar panels coming into the United States, starting in the fourth quarter of 2023 and extending now because the Biden administration had this two-year holiday where you didn't have to pay the solar tariffs, which is coming to an end in June. And so people are rushing to bring in these panels. And so imports were like 54 gigawatts versus, say, a normal demand of 33 gigawatts. So we have this giant surplus of panels from Vietnam and Cambodia and Malaysia and so forth that we also have to work off. And so the competition between the two fuels, I think, is pretty intense. You've got some features like Texas giving subsidies now for companies to put in the natural gas. And like you said, the list of utilities on the Eastern Seaboard anyway that have announced new gas plants. You've got Georgia Power with a 1,400 megawatt new gas plant proposed. You've got Duke saying they're going to build three new power plants with gas. And you've got the giant plant that was a coal plant that might be converted to natural gas by Dominion and Santee Cooper. So there's a lot of gas that's new plants. And so the question of how is this competition going to unfold? So I went to our good friend, Robbie Orvis, and I said, hey, let's update our slide that we'd made on 2030 with the IRA credits, because we'd used $3.50 for natural gas. I said, what if we did it with $2 natural gas? Does that change anything? And ironically, no. Solar still beats natural gas with CCS.
Right. So, yes, solar beats natural gas with CCS. It does not beat natural gas without CCS, right? Carbon capture and storage, that is, just to clarify that acronym.
Yes. Well, but the question is, you know, where are we in 2030? But yes, it's really kind of an interesting question. And then, you know, there's the whole storyline about whether LNG exports are going to knock off coal or are they just going to be blocking renewables in some other place? So it's how do you get there, I think, is a pretty hard question.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a really interesting question, as you say, what's going to happen around the world. But just to go back to the very first thing you were saying then, when you think about where we are right now in the US, as you say, we have a ton of low-cost gas, we have a ton of low-cost solar modules, and there are particular sort of semi-temporary reasons why those prices are particularly low right now. But even so, as a general point, gas is low-cost, solar power is low-cost. That looks like the future, right? The future of the US power system is gas and solar.
Look at low cost.
Yeah.
But we have no transformers. But yes, it's looking low cost.
Yeah, it's looking low cost. And that's where the economics drives you. And even more so, as you say, with the Inflation Reduction Act, the incentives for wind and solar. As I say, what that absolutely is not, though, is a power system with zero emissions. Samantha, what do you think?
Just to back up and broaden it out a little bit, we're acting like this has suddenly just like landed upon us from space as a complete surprise. But it's actually not. I mean, those of us who think about the energy transition a lot, which includes everybody on this broadcast, but we've always known that we need not just a greener power system, a zero carbon power system, but we need a much bigger power system. I don't think we thought perhaps enough about data centers and AI, and the fact that an AI data center may suck down as much power as a small city is something that's quite new to us. You know, we're moving from tens or hundreds of megawatt data centers to gigawatt data centers. I don't think we thought about that quite enough. But the fact that greening the economy, getting to a zero carbon future means electrification is something that's been true the whole time. And so I feel like in some ways we were a bit behind on our thinking about how to get there and not thinking enough about how to not just green the system, but make it bigger. Another thing I want to bring out is this incredibly low-cost natural gas is very true in the United States. We are just blessed with immense natural gas resources that are quite cheap to produce, but that's not necessarily true in the rest of the world. And so the competition among various kinds of renewables, natural gas unabated and with CCS, and in many parts of the world, coal, those are going to stack up quite differently. So this idea that natural gas is an incredibly low-cost fuel is somewhat unique to the United States and other places in the world that have incredibly cheap natural gas. If you look at what has happened in Europe, for instance, as a result of the aggressions of Russia on Ukraine, the loss of Russian gas to Europe, gas has really become a premium fuel, not just in Europe, but in other places in the world.
Well, even in Asia. Yeah, 100%. Oh, absolutely. I mean, LNG to Asia is unbelievably expensive.
Yeah, and one important reason for that is that Europe has sucked in a lot of the world's LNG supplies and outcompeted some of those Asian markets for supply. So this intense competition between solar and gas on price is somewhat unique to the US.
Right. Although, I mean, of course, just as a footnote, you say LNG to Asia is very expensive. The price of that has come down a lot recently just because it's been a warm winter. European demand has not been so high. European gas inventories have been very well stocked. So there hasn't been that tremendous competition for gas.
But Ed, isn't it still expensive compared to either coal or solar in a place like India?
Yeah, no, that is absolutely right. Yeah, in the long run, it's going to be expensive.
So I think the interesting thing about the data centers, just to pick them off the tree for a minute, is that the companies are saying, hey, listen, no, we get it. We're going to go to this hourly 24/7 thing. We are adding renewables so that our extra demand is going to definitely come carbon free. And they have these programs. I think they are, you know, Microsoft, Google, whatever, they're substantial programs. But they now have this new thing, which is that the SEC, if it sticks, is requiring actual material disclosures. And if you're going to announce that you have a strategy and you're going to publish your emissions data and so forth, it's going to have to be accurate here on out. It's not your voluntary system anymore, right? You are having to be accurate. And so I think it'll be really interesting now with the rubber meets the road for all companies, which is companies have made these pledges. They're transparent. They publish what they're doing, but it has to be like doubly accurate now. And you even have to, under the new SEC rules, you have to publish the value or losses of your RECs, and you have to publish the value and losses of your offsets. And so I think that could turn out to be helpful in the sense that companies are going to have to make clear decisions and they can't fudge it. I'm not saying companies did, but now they definitely can't. And hopefully that'll get sort of a faster pace of commitment for the United States anyway. But, you know, like I said, there's a lot of new gas-fired plants that have been announced. And the theory behind every single one of them has to do with a backup of renewables.
Yeah, I mean, I want to sort of come back to the data centers for just a second and the SEC rules. And it is true that many of the very large companies in the data space have been leaders in first promising that they would buy renewable energy certificates to cover all of their power needs, and now moving towards hourly matching and saying, we're actually going to buy power at the time that we use it, which is a very different problem than just covering your kilowatt hours. And so the fact that those very large power consumers are leading the charge towards hourly matching and having renewables available when they're actually using them, it's a bit of optimism. We tend to demonize them for their incredible power use. But if they are leading the charge in thinking about how to provide 24/7 renewables, you know, maybe that's somewhat of a balance.
So let's talk a bit about the solutions. And as you say, ways that you can provide 24/7 low carbon, zero carbon power, which is what these data center companies, the big tech companies, are looking for. I mean, for instance, one of the things I've heard some of them talk about is using gas-fired generators or even diesel generators with biogas or biodiesel, which doesn't really seem ideal. But yeah, I can see, Samantha, you're pulling a face there.
Yeah, that face doesn't show up on radio, but I assure you it was there.
Yeah, so you don't like that as an option. Why not?
Well, you know, I worry about biofuels. Backing up a minute, biofuels, the land use problems, the competition with fuels and other things, the limited supply of like waste oils and greases, for instance, I really want to see those used where you absolutely need them the most. And I'm not convinced that backup power for a data center is the highest and best use for those fuel sources. Some things that I've heard all kinds of solutions to this. I've heard of some of the large data center operators contracting to build small nuclear plants, and these may be a way off. We don't have any SMRs operating in the U.S. today, but it's a good solution for that 24/7 power supply and 24/7 power demand. I've heard of geothermal facilities, and so there's definitely looking at some captive generation that I think is more sustainably zero carbon than the biofuel solutions that you're talking about. But buying it off the market is just hard, and so I think you may see more of these bespoke solutions than going out and buying RECs like you see today.
So listen, there's no question that the Microsofts of this world are looking down the rabbit hole of SMRs. And, you know, I was at a dinner party last week and I have a friend who invested early in SMRs and they're boasting about how they have a site for their SMRs and how SMRs has arrived its time and so forth. And, you know, same thing with the great success of Fervo Energy.
And Fervo Energy, just footnote there, which is a geothermal company, which is doing advanced geothermal, looking very interesting.
But we're talking about scale up here. And first of all, we've discussed on Energy Gang, there is this enriched uranium halo fuel problem for SMRs, number one. And number two, Fervo has to prove what they're doing first, and then later we got to find a second site and so on and so forth. And, you know, same thing for SMRs. I mean, there isn't an SMR that's currently built, right? Apparently there's one in China now. But I mean, the point is, it's not a technology that's off the shelf. We've got 10 plants. We know how we're doing it. Everything's fine. There's fuel for it and so forth. And so I do think there's a challenge. I personally think that we're underutilizing sort of time of day demand management, and especially for where these data centers are and what time of day are they doing their heaviest processing. You know, the companies are just tinkering with that at the very edge, but I think there's a lot of potential. But, you know, I was at a utility conference that was on AI and there were CEOs in the room. And the leader of the conference asked the CEOs to raise their hand if they've started integrating AI into their businesses yet. And no one raised their hand. It was an energy sector meeting. So that potential is there. And indeed, if you're in the field, like say you're a utility or a traditional energy company or whatever, these data center providers are also coming into the home. You know what I mean? They're coming in with their thermostats and they're taking over the retail level.
Although I have to say that I think a lot of that may end up being good. Maybe I'm just an optimist. But I'm smiling and thinking back to an energy markets class that I took in 2002 at UC Berkeley, where we talked a lot about the beauty of time of day pricing and how it could reduce the need for additional generation and make the grid run more efficiently, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Here we are in 2024 and we're still not doing enough.
Yeah, we're talking about, we haven't done it yet. We're just still talking about it.
No, we're still talking about it. And, you know, I've been out of school a long time. But I also think that there's space for smarter grids and these smarter appliances, possibly AI enabled, to sort of change the pattern of use, smooth it out a little bit and reduce the need for additional resources. And so I think like the data centers for AI are clearly giant power demand centers, but one hopes that the AI itself gets used for things like helping manage the grid better and for uses that can perhaps make up, in my little air quotes, for some of the power demand.
Well, that raises an interesting question, not having done the life cycle analysis of it. Like, when I'm doing this demand management thing and I'm shaving off, you know, I don't know, 5%, 10% of demand.
How much power does that
only
take?
Covering the computation of doing that. I mean, because we're all busy. Ed mentioned biofuels. You know, I've trained a lot of people who now are in jobs where their job is to compare the life cycle emissions for biodiesel, for the different colors of hydrogen, for all those things. And we kind of have a better understanding of that now, especially even taking into account how we're managing land is, you know, what's my source of the material. But do we have a grip on how much AI it takes to have my garage charge my car at exactly the right time and not at the right time? And how much energy does that actually use?
It's a fantastic question.
I guess somebody's probably done a study on that, but it's not a widely known thing.
No, and it's a great question because we hear about the promise that this computational power will bring us, but, you know, yeah, how much does it cost in terms of energy use?
And also, in a way, it's not the relevant question, is it? Because the uses of energy that we know about are not going to be the uses of energy in the future. And that whatever you can do now with AI, there's going to be all kinds of other things that probably we can't even think of. If you'd thought even 30 years ago, say, you know, the internet's just emerging, oh, most of us will be doing most of our shopping on the internet, or all of us will be watching all of the movies we watch on the internet, or whatever it might be. Most people certainly would not have expected those uses. And as technology evolves, it always throws up new possibilities, new potential. And there was quite a good piece in the New Yorker I was reading about this the other day, which had a great quote on Reeves. I think it's very relevant, which is, how can the world reach net zero if it keeps inventing new ways to consume energy? Quite a good question, but it seems to me very clarifying in terms of what the issue is, because we are going to keep thinking of new ways to consume energy. People are going to stop inventing things. That's impossible. So actually, whatever our path to net zero is, has to be consistent with new uses of energy turning up all the time. As I say, things we haven't even imagined yet.
Absolutely. Human progress is never going to stop, and we're always going to want new things and new technologies, and they're naturally going to use probably electricity. And acting like we can stop and just convert the system we have is bananas.
Right. So let me just say the following thing, which is really out there. And maybe that comes from being situated at a school where we have a famous gaming master's degree and we have a film school and so forth. You mentioned how, and we just had the Oscars, and how many of us are actually seeing those films in a movie theater. And indeed, there was just an article, I think it was Wall Street Journal, about how everybody built these giant sound stages anticipating we're all going to have all this streaming content. And now a lot of that stuff that they used to do in a soundstage, they're going to be able to do with AI. So that's just like in a 2-year period, the film industry realized they made this mistake. So I do see that. But the interesting question is, just generationally, people consume a lot of stuff. And that stuff, shipping the stuff around, wearing the stuff, and then getting rid of the stuff, all of that takes a lot of energy. But if I could channel my owning stuff feelings into my virtual life, right? So I could have a beautiful gown that I would wear in my virtual life. I mean, they have fashion shows already in virtual world, okay? I mean, I understand what I'm saying sounds ridiculous, but it's really not. So if I had a beautiful mansion and beautiful stuff on my avatar in my virtual life, could I buy less in my real life? In the end, I'm not saying that people couldn't squelch their need to express themselves, but if I expressed myself in my virtual life, could I consume less in my real life? And I think that it could be like a future question, even though that sounds crazy and very science fiction-y. Like, I just saw a thing where people are dating people who are avatars and they're not lonely anymore. Like, we're moving into a totally different world.
Yeah, maybe for some of the young folks who are digital natives and are sort of used to living more of their lives online. I can go for less stuff, but I want my stuff to be real.
But you're right. It does sound very science fictional. But I do think, actually, when we start thinking about AI and the rise of AI, that's very science fictional. When you hear a lot of people talk about, oh, the answer to meeting the power demand for this is going to be nuclear fusion, and that's going to be the thing that'll provide the electricity we want. It does feel like at some point, some of these science fiction ideas are actually intersecting with the real world. So yeah, maybe it's not. So just to get clear, something I think I heard both of you say in terms of these ideas about demand-side response, flexible demand of various kinds, as you said, something that we've been talking about for a long time has not really come in any size as a regularly useful part of the power system. Are you essentially saying that yes, it can play a role, it will have some impact, but it can't be the answer to everything that's happening in terms of new demands on the grid, these enormous new loads that are emerging, and the new variability that's being created by renewable energy? I mean, that's something which I hear quite a bit from people in the utility industry, which is, as I say, yes, demand-side response plays a role. It just doesn't play a big enough role to really solve these problems for us. Fair?
So I don't really agree with that. I think that's a utility mindset, right, of executives whose job it's been to get higher electricity use so they get more payout for their utility. That is a pricing reform problem. And, you know, if there was a new generation of leaders in utilities, we might have a totally different system. We might have more, you know, DERs and virtual power plants. Like, I'm not sure I agree with that. You know, I used to write about this thing, which I used to call the democratization of energy, where I'm like, I could control what I choose to use in my own little system at home or in my community or in my apartment building. And I think in that world where it isn't, you know, some person, I won't name names, from utility A or utility B saying they have to use coal because they're in India, or they have to use natural gas because they're in Texas. I think if we had a really, what I call democratized, like a really distributed system, maybe we really could get there, and demand management and things like that could make a really big difference. That is my view. Maybe that's too optimistic, but that's my, you know, utopian view of where we would go in the future.
Samantha, what do you think?
I think demand management is such a potential resource because we haven't really tried. Like I said earlier, we really just haven't put any effort into this. And the general understanding is that power comes from the wall. For most people, I mean, let's be honest, is they don't think about where it comes from. They don't understand that it matters when they use it. And they don't want to think about that. They've got better things to do. But if you automate this, if you make it simple for people and cheaper, if it's both simple and cheaper, then I think people will do it. And I think it can make a difference. And I think we don't know how much potential is out there because we haven't tried.
And do you agree with Amy's point that a lot of it is to do with failure of leadership, that it's leadership in the industry, among regulators, among politicians? If, as you say, we just tried harder, we actually would get to some very significant results.
Well, I do think it's part of that, because, and if you think about the traditional utility model, it has been building power plants and selling electrons. And this is a different way of modeling your business and making money. And hey, we know nobody likes change. It takes a while to sort of think about how to restructure your business and make money in a different environment. So I do think that's part of it. And I think it's also, I don't want to call people lazy. I mean, everybody has too many things going on. A, nobody got time for thinking about how to shape their power demand to make the grid happier. But if you automate it, I think you can get people to do it.
This gets to like a workforce thing. So I'm a utility. I mean, forget even a utility like in California, where hopefully they have a few people. You know, I'm a utility in other countries or even in other parts of the United States. And do I have enough people trained in machine learning and AI to even launch a program? Right. But I do think that, you know, eventually children that are 5 years old to 10 years old today, I mean, AI is going to be what they're doing every day. It's not going to be this thing that the rest of us have to learn how to use. And, you know, did Ed use it when he did his intro to the show today or not? You know what I mean? Like, the Ed of the future is going to say, we're having a show on this topic.
That was a digitally produced Ed. That wasn't the real Ed.
And actually, it happens already. You know, you can have an AI-delivered podcast now with all the script and even the voices created entirely by AI.
And would they be as good as Sam's AI? I don't think so. I feel not.
I was just going to say, I assure you that this is the real Samantha sitting in a studio in front of a microphone. I promise.
Yes, hopefully we can hang on to our jobs doing this podcast for just a little bit longer anyway.
At least for now.
Exactly, exactly. So look, I want to move on, because the other big thing I want to talk about today is this question of the 1.5 degree centigrade limit for global warming, which is very tightly tied, of course, to the question of net zero and whether we can achieve it. Essentially, to limit global warming since pre-industrial times to 1.5 degrees C, you need to get to net zero emissions globally by around the middle of this century, 2050 or thereabouts, so really in a very short space of time. And it seems that the chorus is growing, saying that actually that 1.5 degree limit is no longer achievable. There was some analysis put out recently by the Copernicus Climate Change Service, which is the EU's climate science group, and that said that up until January of this year, we'd already experienced a full 12-month period of more than 1.5 degrees C above pre-industrial levels of global warming. So in other words, we've got to 1.5 degrees already. That may not last. We may drop back again over the next few years. There's various things going on, the El Nino effect and so on, that are meaning that temperatures are higher at the moment. But even so, people think that even if we haven't crossed that 1.5 degree threshold already, we will cross it soon. But you still have lots of businesses and governments that are saying, oh, we have these climate goals, these objectives, these strategies that are, at least in theory, aligned with that goal of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees. The question, does that make sense? Would it be better for us to move to a more realistic objective rather than trying to delude ourselves that 1.5 degrees is still possible. Samantha, what do you think?
It's a terrific question. And I think we have to remember that there isn't some sort of cliff. We reach 1.5 degrees of warming and then we fall off a cliff and everything goes to hell. This is a system that gets worse as temperatures rise as a result of emissions going up. 1.5 degrees was never going to be easy. I feel like after the IPCC report came out a few years ago, describing the difference between 1.5 degrees of warming and 2, the world really switched over to this 1.5 to stay alive mantra. But it's always been a difficult stretch goal, and it has always been something we weren't sure we could achieve. Another thing I want to point out is I feel like we sometimes get caught in this 1.5 to stay alive mindset, and we forget how far we've come. I have a young Princeton graduate who works for me as a research assistant, and she's my Gen Z representative in my life. She keeps me abreast of what the kids are thinking. And I've asked her, tell me what your friends think about climate. If you ask them questions, what do they say? How do they feel? And they're very much just fatalistic. We're doomed. We're not doing anything. The world is terrible. The older generations have ruined the world for us. And it makes me really sad because if you look at what has happened to date, not very long ago, a decade or so, we were on path for 4 degrees C of warming, maybe more. And if you look at the path we're on right now, it's 2 and change, maybe 2.5. That is a huge difference and a really important difference in the effects that we're going to see. Are we all the way there yet? No. But are we on a path where we're bending the emissions curve towards ever lower endpoints in warming? Yes. And so we need to keep doing what we're doing. We need to keep bending the curve. We need to see how close to 1.5 we can get. But I get really bummed out when we're so focused on that 1.5 goal that we leave young people just feeling like the world is ending and feeling like we're not doing anything when neither one of those things is true.
You know, I just love what Samantha's saying. I mean, it's so important. And then also, when we think about, you know, Ed, you mentioned that it's an El Nino year. So, you know, you have to take that into account. But even beyond that, I don't even know if there's scientific consensus, like how many decades at a certain degree do we say that we've breached it and therefore we're there? So this isn't the this year or next year problem. But if you look at the 2030 trajectory, we need to be going down every year. And, you know, IEA statistics are that we added 37 billion metric tons of energy-related CO2 emissions in 2023. So I agree with Samantha's saying. I remember when we were arguing about whether we could hold the 4 degrees. So we're definitely making progress. And as we said at the top of the show, solar and some of these other technologies, the prices are really coming down. And so it's easier to quote unquote make the right choice. But we need to keep pushing because to get an 8% decline in emissions a year between now and 2030 is really a heavy lift. We need to at least get to no rising emissions. And the question is, can we do that? What happens with the US elections and some of these other key elections? You know, we have upcoming climate meetings where we don't have a really clean agenda for how we're going to pay for emissions reductions, you know, outside of the Western industrial countries. And we have to solve that because we do have this ticking clock and it is possible. And it's not 100% true that we, you know, a lot of people say we don't have the technologies yet. Well, yeah, we have a lot of technologies that we could deploy that, like we were just talking about, where we haven't had a conscious enough effort. And I think it's still possible to be more conscious. So like Samantha's saying, you know, it's not a cliff. Like we don't have to this year get to a certain thing. We're trying for a trajectory. And I do think that, you know, separate from government regulation, private companies have made these pledges. And that's where the power comes in. If these companies start to reverse themselves in a sort of backlash effect, to me, that's actually almost a bigger problem than what governments are announcing.
I think something that we also don't necessarily recognize is that there's still low-hanging fruit in emissions reductions, maybe less so in the United States, in the EU, and in places that are pushing really hard. But in middle-income countries, a lot of which have seriously significant emissions, they're still working to phase out coal. There's still a lot of energy efficiency work that can be done. And so not only are we on a better trajectory than we were not so long ago, I don't think we've picked all the low-hanging fruit yet. And so I'm with you, Ed, that I think 1.5 is really hard. But I also think that not only are we in a better place, I think there's still relatively easy reductions to be found.
I agree with you 100%. But, you know, one of the things I'm hearing in the corporate sector, again, I was at a function and someone was telling me that their management didn't want to include the IEA net zero scenario in their write-up of the worldview because it was so unrealistic, let's not use it anymore. And I do think that there is some power to pushing back on this narrative that somehow 1.5 degrees is unachievable. Because once we do that, the question is, am I relieving you of your responsibilities that you already said you'd take, right? And so I do think it's important for specialists to push back on that meme and say, listen, you know, 1.5 degrees is a decadal target. And 1 year doesn't change that. We need to keep trying.
You'd have to be so careful with that message because, yeah, you do not want to encourage companies to take their foot off the accelerator or to pull back on promises they've made. But I think the flip side that sometimes happens with the 1.5 degree goal is we get really prescriptive about how we have to get there. You see that a lot in EU regulation, for instance. And so you want to find a way to get there. You don't want companies to pull back on goals that they've made, but you also want to leave it open to innovation and new technologies and not get super prescriptive in a overzealous effort to make sure we get there. And that's just a hard line to walk.
Right. But I think you've both just touched on the issue I really want to get to the heart of here, which is this question of how worthwhile is it to have a target that we don't realistically think we're going to hit. And that does seem to be the absolute crux of the issue, right? As you say everything about very real progress that's been made, genuine achievements of climate policy, very positive and encouraging trends in terms of investment in renewables, falling cost of renewable energy, all of that. Yeah, okay, accept all of that. Absolutely taken entirely in agreement with you on that. The question I have is, if we're not going to get to 1.5, you both seem to be saying, but we shouldn't actually admit that. We shouldn't admit that we're not getting to 1.5. We should still act as if we are going to get to 1.5 because it's somehow sort of constructive or positive to have this goal, which is super demanding, a real stretch target. And I'm questioning whether that's really true and whether it would actually be better to sort of basically admit defeat on that one, but say there is something. And even as I'm saying it now, I can see the problem in saying this, which is, oh, yeah, okay, that target we've given up on, but this one we are actually going to stick to. I can see that's a tricky message to give to people. But as I say, I just wonder what the real value is in trying to achieve something that's unachievable.
Well, the way I think about it is you have to think about what happens if you don't hit the target. Stretch goals are great. We should all have stretch goals in our life. They give us a North Star, someplace to think about where we want to go. But we have to think about what happens if those goals aren't met, or if parts of the goals are met and parts aren't. And do we have punitive actions that happen if we do not reach emissions goals? Do we have actions that might actually cause pain, economic pain, difficulties for people? If we go there, then it becomes problematic. So I'm concerned when you get policies in place that get punitive when you don't reach certain goals, because my biggest concern in all of climate policy everywhere in the world is that we lose the public. If we lose the public, if the public is unhappy, if they feel like dealing with climate change is making their lives worse, well, who cares about this climate problem? You know, my bills are higher today, or I'm not getting what I need today. If we lose the public, we're dead. And so I'm okay with having stretch goals, but I don't want them to get punitive in ways where we lose people.
So Samantha, I'm 100% with you. And how do we make climate-friendly goals pointing to a better life? I mean, I think that's critically important. And the problem that I see with that messaging and so-called changing the goalpost, as they say, is that you get people saying, like, I was at a forum where I kind of got in a little bit of a debate with someone, and they were from the energy industry, and they made this statement about how, listen, this climate change thing, it's just not that bad. That's a great thing to say when you're a wealthy executive living in the United States and you can take a plane to your summer house. But if you are living in Jakarta and there's 2 million of you that are having to move to the middle of nowhere to function, to run your country because you have to go to higher ground, and then the other millions of people who lived in that metro area of Jakarta know that they're going to be underwater, underwater, underwater with increasing regularity, and you've got school children sitting in a classroom and the water's covering their feet and there's no being dry. Like, to have someone who doesn't live in that circumstance say that the consequences of this 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees just, quote unquote, isn't that bad. I mean, we're talking about entire population centers needing to move millions of people. So I think that we have to weigh the costs of moving millions of people against the costs of trying to hit these so-called unrealistic goals. And I think, you know, in today's world, actually, I agree, it's harder. And why is it harder? Because to get people who are facing inflation in the United States or Europe or Japan or someplace like that to see the people who can't live where they've lived for decades and actually care about that enough to change their own personal lifestyle, that is what's been a tough sell. And you see it at the climate negotiations. I mean, I think the climate negotiations, if you go back and watch some of the video again from COP28, the kinds of things that people from countries that are facing inundation or facing intense heat, the kinds of things that representatives from those countries said was really powerful and compelling, and yet they were ignored.
It's moving and painful, and you're completely right, Amy. I feel like you've hit on the absolute most difficult thing about climate change, and that is that wealthy people like us are responsible for the lion's share of emissions that are in the atmosphere now. Current emissions right now, ours are going down, US and Europe. Middle-income countries, a lot of them significant emitters, are still growing. But the problem is we need buy-in from those significant emitters today, and you need to hang on to those publics to continue to do things to save the lives and livelihoods of people they'll never meet in Africa and Bangladesh and in the small island states. And it's the reason why climate change is such a bear. It's like the fundamental issue at stake.
I want to add one last thing to the point, Ed, and then I'll quiet myself down. So, you know, recently we had a screening of the film Inundation District at NYU for our students. And David Abel, the filmmaker, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, came to do a talk back. And the point of that film was that you had this entire quote unquote innovation district in Boston, where all these data center companies, by the way, have their offices now, in addition to Shell and some other companies. And it was built on landfill with the full knowledge that we're having inundation in the city of Boston exactly in that location. And yet they spent billions of dollars building new industrial things to so-called raise the economy of Boston and make it competitive, say, to Silicon Valley. Well, we're building things in places where we know we should be doing sustainable retreat, and we're unable to even make those basic decisions.
And that's in a wealthy area where people have the money and the wherewithal to make different decisions.
Correct. I mean, take Boston as just an unbelievable example. You have MIT, Harvard, Tufts, all these schools at the forefront of climate science and sustainability practice and blah, blah, blah. And yet in that very city, they did this unbelievably stupid thing. They weren't even defending buildings that they cared about, that, you know, like, they're not Miami, where they wanted to somehow defend the tourist industry of South Beach. I mean, they built something new. And so I do think, like we said earlier, like, actually forget talking about it on a podcast. Like, people need to incorporate climate risk thinking into their planning, whether you're a city, whether you're a company. We need to get in a totally different head.
Back to those SEC regulations.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
I mean, it's great, actually, for all the brouhaha you've seen over those. They really are an attempt by the U.S. government to force companies, because that's what you have to do sometimes, to consider climate risks and to bring information to investors so they can do the same. So we had a long way to go, but we're trying anyway.
Yeah, that is a great point. Now, Amy's point there about, as you say, the crucial climate solutions are the ones that also make people's lives immediately better. I think that's a great segue into the final thing I wanted to talk about, which is Chinese EVs, because I've been really struck by some of the numbers, both in what's been happening to sales of EVs in China and also what's been happening to the prices. We were talking about EVs on the show the other day with Melissa Lott and Jessica Tranchik, and saying despite all the adverse publicity about EVs, actually the industry is doing fine. I think it's definitely the case that in China things are a lot better than fine. I mean, if you look at what China calls new energy vehicles, sales of those were up 37.5% in the first 2 months of 2024 compared to the same period of 2023. That's actually an acceleration in the pace of growth in those cars. And that's new energy vehicles, that's battery electrics, plug-in hybrids, and fuel cell vehicles. So no sign really of loss of momentum there. Things still are going very strongly. And the prices are being cut very dramatically. There was an estimate from Reuters saying that BYD, you know, the big Chinese electric vehicle company, the biggest in the country, that has cut the prices of its EVs by an average of 17%. And some of these deals seem amazing. There's a BYD Yuan Plus, which is a reasonable size car. You can get one of those in China for about 120,000 yuan. That is less than $17,000 for really a very decent vehicle. It seems like an absolutely great price. If you look at export markets, it's more than that. I think I've seen quotes in Mexico, that same car is going for about 800,000 pesos. That's about $48,000, so much less of a bargain. But in the Philippines, not so much. I think it's 1.6 million pesos there. That's about $29,000. And it does seem to be the case that China's exports of EVs are surging as well. Just has that feeling that there's really some momentum gathering here, and this point about the prices of EVs dropping to where they're going to be cheaper than equivalent internal combustion engine vehicles, that's coming very soon, and probably in China has already been passed. And it does very much seem to be Chinese manufacturers leading the way. I suppose there's various ways to view this, and one is, as I say, it's great news for consumers, it's great news for people looking to shift to an EV. It's great news because lifetime emissions from using an EV are typically lower than for using an internal combustion engine vehicle. Obviously, it depends where you're getting your electricity from, but most times, most places, you save in emissions terms, and clearly there's a potential to save much more as the grid in general gets greener and lower emissions. But for established manufacturers in North America, in Europe, anyone that's locked into internal combustion engine vehicles must be quite alarming, I would think. Samantha, what do you think about this? How are you viewing this amazing rise of Chinese EVs?
Yeah, Ed, your intro raises a couple questions for me. One of them is, it sounds to me like competition in the EV market in China is just cutthroat. I mean, part of the reason why you're seeing them push so hard for exports is I wonder if they're making any money in the home market. $17,000 for that BYD vehicle, can they make money at that rate? I kind of have my doubts. And so I think part of the reason why you may see the Chinese companies pushing so hard for exports, not just so they can grow, but also to find markets where they can make some money, because the competition looks so cutthroat in their home market in China. Another thing is, China does have a head start on electric vehicle manufacturing, no question. The Chinese government pushed really hard on manufacturers to do this, and that has paid off. They have some quite mature electric vehicle manufacturers in the country. But I spent some time over the past couple of days with vehicle manufacturers here in the United States, and they're all in on electrics. It just takes a while to switch over your manufacturing, to get enough vehicles sold. I mean, this is not a one-year switch. Vehicle manufacturers make decisions well in advance. They have to design whole platforms. An electric vehicle is very different under the hood than an internal combustion engine vehicle. Seems obvious, but a lot of changes in the manufacturing process and the kind of materials you need. But when you speak to them, they're all in. They're like, this is our future. This is what we're doing. And so they have a bit to catch up, and where they'll end up on the price scale is a very good question. But there is no question that they are moving in that direction. I think the question is whether China pushes EVs into these markets at losses like they've done for some other products, solar panels, critical minerals, where they are selling at a loss to try to gain market share and to push out competitors. If they do that in EVs, it's going to be challenging. But there's no question that the US and European manufacturers are on board and moving forward with their EV plans.
I agree with Samantha that car companies, the big manufacturers, they have decadal decisions, 10-year plans for the platforms. You know, we've heard all these news stories about people, quote unquote, pulling the plug, but it's actually hard to pull the plug when you make these commitments to manufacturing. So I do think EVs are here to stay. But I will say, I don't know, it was a week or so ago, we had a really, really, really cold day here. And my husband and I had trouble charging the EV. And we've talked on the show about his EV skepticism, and he went mental. He says, I don't think you understand. You don't understand. We're not ready for this. We can't have a car that we can't suddenly use. And he just went like off the wall about this problem of winter and EVs. And luckily, the next day it was a little warmer and we were able to charge the car. But we had driven the car like we usually do, and it was kind of at a low rate, and we were past the rate where we could drive to our dealer, which we won't do again. But it did raise these questions about infrastructure. And I have a whole chapter in my book. People do not remember how bad the infrastructure was when ICE cars were first rolled out and unbelievable difficulties that people had using those cars, including breaking their arms and having the car explode when they were fueling it, or crashing the car, having to leave the car on the road because the axle broke. Like, there were a lot of problems. And that gets us back to what we were talking about, which is, you know, do people have the tolerance to get through this issue, right? In China, you kind of have no choice, because in the old days, you wanted a license plate, you had to take an EV.
The infrastructure, I think, is the biggest question. And I think we're not even talking about range anxiety anymore. We're talking about charger anxiety. How far away is the nearest charger? Will that charger work when you get there? Will there be a line at that charger? Whereas we live in a world where we're used to having a gas station on almost every corner, and sometimes more than one. And so we are not there yet in terms of EV infrastructure. And in order for ordinary people like Amy's husband to want to adopt EVs, we have to grow the infrastructure. And so we've got a chicken egg problem here. And you see the government working on that and putting in subsidies to build more chargers, because the truth of the matter is, until there are more EVs on the road, these things aren't as economic as you would like them to be. But the EVs don't get sold until there's more infrastructure. And so this is clearly an area where government can help and goose the market. But we're not quite there yet, and we don't have the charger infrastructure we need for mass adoption.
Right. No, that is a really good point. And actually, clearly, that is one area where the election result this year in the US could make a big difference if we get a change of administration.
Absolutely.
I saw former President Donald Trump had been talking to Elon Musk the other day, and he'd said something like, oh, we agreed on lots of things. There was one little thing we didn't agree on, and that was electric vehicles.
Has Trump ever driven one?
I don't think so, no. But he does talk about them quite a bit. It's very clear he is opposed. And so certainly I think if he does get back into the White House, we would see an administration that is very much set against EVs and is trying to slow adoption.
Well, and the GOP is already trying to take the individual subsidies out of the budget for even this coming year. So I think there's a clear partisan divide on whether or not public money should go to helping this infrastructure move forward.
Yeah, okay, I have an idea. I think what we need to do is we need to take former President Trump, the House Speaker, whoever else from the GOP would like to come, and we need to take him out to a track with a couple of fun SUVs. You know, get him a nice Tesla, get him maybe an SUV of some kind. The Mini Cooper EV is quite a lot of fun. And take him out there and just tell him to go nuts and see how they feel afterwards. Because we're not there yet with the infrastructure, but once we are, these things are a fine product. And so that's my proposal.
Yeah, that is a great idea. Yes. And I do think that issue of Chinese strength in EVs is going to be very important in that political debate, because there's two ways you could take that, right? And the way that the Biden administration seems to be taking it, saying EVs are the future, and if China's strong, then America needs to be strong. We need to build ourselves up in that area. But there's another way to look at it, and you could say, if China is strong in EVs, we need to stop EVs being the future, and we need to make sure we are as strong as we can be in internal combustion engine vehicles. And that's an interesting contrast, definitely.
So listen, EV purchases in places like Southeast Asia and India and other places, Latin America, are on the rise. And indeed, I really do think the Republicans get the thing about Chinese competition on semiconductors. They get some of these other issues. And if the world starts moving to this technology, because honestly, if I had it charging and that worked, it is absolutely a superior car. So if the United States just stops doing it, it's like, what if we went back to analog telephones? We'd all save a lot of money, right? But who in the world would want to give up their smartphone if they had one? Because it's more than a phone. So I think that that's where we want to go with EVs. We eventually want to get, for some functions, you know, whether it's buses or ride service, we want to get that to be automated and safe, right? Because that also saves fuel, but also reduces congestion and the time in cities. So we kind of know where we're trying to go. And I think one has to really go to the Hill and explain to people, not only like Samantha's saying, we not only need to put them in my car and drive them around and charge it for a minute, right? We need to have them understand that we're talking about a competitive landscape where we've been this before. People want big cars, right? People wanted big cars. And then the Japanese came out with these unbelievably fuel efficient cars and everybody switched to them. And then people said, well, we still want big cars. And so the Japanese and others came up with a big car that was totally fuel efficient and nobody bought American cars. And then we used to manufacture American cars to become obsolete because you figured you wanted you to buy a new car every 3 years. And then that turned out to be not what people actually wanted to do. So again, people bought foreign cars. So, you know, we've almost decimated the entire car industry in this country, and we've bailed them out multiple times. And if we're going to now reverse it back to something that's not going to sell in the future, that's not just a partisan thing. That's just stupid.
Yeah, that is a fantastic point. As you say, those who do not remember history are condemned to repeat it. It'll be interesting to see whether people take those lessons on board. So look, we do unfortunately have to leave it there. I see we're all running towards our deadlines and we've got other things to go and do. Very quickly though, before we go, free electrons, personal items that we've brought in. Samantha, what's yours?
Okay, so Ed, Amy, everybody who's listening, I have a confession to make. I just bought a new car and I am the poster child for the infrastructure problems with electrics. I live in an apartment building with a very small number of EV chargers, and I do a lot of rural road trips. And I did not buy an electric car as much as I wanted to. It killed me. I actually bought a used car, hoping that I would trade it in sooner than I usually do. But I'm a tiny car girl, and I bought myself a Mini Cooper 2.0. So hopefully when the charging infrastructure gets better, and when I live in a place or when the place I live has more charging infrastructure, I'll go electric next time. But that's my confession to the world.
Well, I'm sure we'll all forgive you. As Amy has been saying, as you've been saying as well, those issues are real with infrastructure and charging. Those really do need to get fixed.
And when they are, I'll go electric. But until then, my British Racing Green Mini Cooper will be serving me well.
Oh, no, those are great cars as well, I have to say. Not sure, is there an electric version? I don't know.
There is, and they are fun.
Yeah.
But they have quite a short range. And because I live in the city, I'm absolutely diehard about small cars. And I just couldn't get what I wanted in an electric in addition to the infrastructure problems. So doggone it, I talk about how great they are and I'm not kidding, but here I am.
Next time, as you say.
Exactly.
Amy, what's yours?
So mine is that I watched the Oscars And I was disappointed with how few comments there were about anything other than that actor or director or technician's own experience of their film. And there was virtually zero reference to climate change at all. And even with a film about nuclear power and nuclear weapons, well, more nuclear weapons than nuclear power, being center stage at a time when the world is at war, there was even barely a mention of nuclear. And so I'm shouting out to Hollywood, super disappointed, super, super disappointed. I get it. You know, you all talked about your gowns because you haven't been able to go anywhere in person in all those clothes, but get back on mission.
That is a great point. What I'm going to say to you is wait till next year when Dune Part 2 is sweeping the board at the Oscars a year from now, which I think it is very likely to do, having seen it last weekend. It is a fantastic film. Dune, of course, is an allegory about oil and the Middle East and energy in general, and that's the perfect time. And it's also about ecology and the environment and water scarcity. So that's definitely going to be the time when people will be talking about nothing but climate, I'm sure. So watch out for the Oscars a year from now. We can certainly hope. And if actually they don't talk about all those issues, then that will definitely be a missed opportunity, I think. So mine, very quickly, I just wanted to highlight the work being done by an organization called Let's Share the Sun, which provides rooftop solar and microgrids for low-income communities suffering from energy insecurity. Makes a fantastic difference in those places by providing people with distributed energy. I was reading about the work they're doing in Puerto Rico, where the power goes out, I think, 6 times a month, typically. So having your own local power source can be absolute lifesaver. Really great work they're doing in that. As they go and look them up on the internet, letssavethesun.org. And it's something that we at Wood Mackenzie are supporting. And I've just had a group of colleagues out there in Puerto Rico helping with installations of these solar systems and microgrids out there. So it's really important, valuable work that they're doing. And I just wanted to celebrate them and thank them for everything they're doing. So we do, unfortunately, have to leave it there. Many thanks, Samantha.
Always a pleasure.
Many thanks, Amy.
Great to see you both.
Yeah, great to see you both again. Thanks to our producers, Sam Nash and Toby Biggins-Gilchrist. And above all, many thanks to all of you for listening. As ever, we're very keen to hear from you. You can find us as The Energy Gang and me personally on all the usual social media platforms. And we'll be back in 2 weeks with all the latest news and views from the energy transition. Until then, goodbye.